From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack.
And thanks for joining us this weekend. We can tell you a lot of things from this week to talk about, and we're going to start right here. A woman from Rochester had her picture go viral this week. Stephanie Woodward was carried out of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office during a protest over proposed Medicaid cuts. Woodward is with the Center for Disability Rights in Rochester. She uses a wheelchair herself, and Capitol Police forcefully removed her, along with a group of other demonstrators.
Woodward joined us to talk about that experience, including the impact from that photo going viral.
That was not anticipated whatsoever. I was just there to fight for the life and liberty of people with disabilities.
I'm looking at this picture, and listeners, you've probably seen it as well from that incident last week, and it's a picture of, were they Capitol Police?
Yes.
Capitol Police carrying Stephanie out, and Stephanie's outreached arm, and a little look of dismay on your face. I know you've been arrested before 13 times now, so this wasn't new for you, but what was the experience last Thursday like for you?
It was a really empowering experience to be surrounded by 60 other people with disabilities fighting for their rights and for their lives. So a lot of the people I was protesting with use home and community-based services, and this will hit very hard for them if they lose their attendance and their ability to live in the community. So to be able to do a die-in with people who I consider my family at this point to save their lives and their rights, it was really empowering and important to me.
Did you expect to be arrested?
We knew that there was a chance to be arrested. So the way it works is usually if you're in the hallways of the Capitol building and you are blocking the hallway, that's Capitol Police territory. So we could expect that Capitol Police will arrest you there. However, many of us were actually in the office, and that is the senator's territory. So if the senator doesn't request you to be arrested, then no one will come and get you. They have to make that request. So it's similar to right now. We have about 15 protesters in Senator Gardner's office in Colorado right now, and they've been there for 40 hours now, and he hasn't requested that they be arrested so they can just stay. So,
how long were you there in McConnell's office?
Probably only an hour. So he requested us to be arrested pretty quickly.
This is sort of a strange question, but were Capitol Police, do they do their job reluctantly? Were they rough? I mean, what was that experience like?
They did their job. They were there to do their job, and I was there to do mine. It just so happened that our jobs contradicted that day. Some of them were not pleased with us. Others were rather sympathetic with us, particularly when they were holding us for about 10 hours afterwards. We had some Capitol Police who really treated us well and even stayed past the hours that they were supposed to be working in solidarity with us until all of us were released.
Is it surreal to be carried out, though? I mean, this image has gone viral. It has been linked to by numerous news sites. It has been sort of a rallying cause for a lot of people who are looking at what's going on in the disabilities community and otherwise to understand what's going on there. Is that surreal for you? I mean, this is probably the most publicity your face has gotten since you've done activist work.
Since I've been born, I'm pretty
sure. Yeah, yes.
Yeah, it is surreal because the disability rights community has been doing this for a very long time. ADAPT has been around for over 35 years, fighting for disability rights, doing this stuff all of the time. And I've been carried out of other offices before. I've been cuffed before. And I didn't think that it was going to impact people as much as it does because no one seemed to have listened before. So I'm so glad that the American people are listening now.
Why do you think they are now?
Maybe because they realize that this is lives are at stake. Lives are genuinely at stake. And people with disabilities, I don't think that they could fathom that people with disabilities would go and fight so hard for their rights. There is this stereotype that people with disabilities can't fight for themselves or can't speak for themselves and others have to do it for them. And now they're seeing that, no, we will fight for ourselves and for our lives.
Next, a conversation about how journalists decide what to cover and what not to cover. NBC's Megyn Kelly took some heat for her decision to interview conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. Jones has millions of daily listeners to his programs, and President Trump has praised his work.
That work includes claiming that the Sandy Hook school shootings were a hoax and that no children actually died that day. Of course, that's sick and wrong, and critics said that Megyn Kelly should not have given a platform to someone with ideas this toxic. Our panel discussed how journalists make these calls. First, you're going to hear a clip of Jones talking to Megyn Kelly on her show about his Sandy Hook ideas. Then you'll hear RIT's journalism professor Andrea Hickerson, along with WROC-TV anchor Adam Chodak.
I will sit there on the air and look at every position and play devil's advocate.
Was that devil's advocate? The whole thing is a giant hoax. The whole thing was fake.
Yes, because I remember in even that day, I'll go back from memory, then saying, but then some of it looks like it's real. But then what do you do when they've got the kids going in circles in and out of the building with their hands up? I've watched the footage and it looks like a drill.
When you say parents faked their children's death, people get very angry.
Yeah, well, I know, but they don't get angry about the 500,000 dead Iraqis from the sanctions, or they don't get angry about all the
illegals
pouring in. No, it's not a dodge. The media never covers all the evil wars it's promoted, all the
big
things.
That doesn't excuse what you did and said about Newtown.
Here's the difference. Here's the difference. I looked at all the angles of Newtown, and I made my statements long before the media even picked up on it.
In our interview, we asked Jones numerous times what he now believes, and he never completely disavowed his previous statements.
I tend to believe that children probably did die there. But then you look at all the other evidence on the other side, I can see how other people believe that nobody died there.
Of course, there is no evidence on the other side.
Professor Hickerson?
I think this is where the interview didn't go so well for Megyn Kelly, because what she did is she just kind of called him out a little bit, but he keeps talking about the media. So he's setting himself in opposition to who she is, and he's also describing himself in a way that a journalist might. I've looked at all the angles, you didn't look at all the angles. And this is where I think that this interview ultimately reinforces that his base group of people, that, you know, he is not the media. He didn't go on to this interview to convince anyone that he was somehow somebody new. I mean, he stuck to his guns and his base there. And so that's where I think that she really missed an opportunity to tease that out. And in the end, the script was exactly as maybe you could have predicted before the interview even went on.
Okay. Adam Chodak?
You know, I was hoping to come on and be a contrarian here, but I 100% agree. I think what we saw there was a well-produced representation of what is so wrong with how we interview people, especially at the national level. Look at what she asked for. She asked for, do you believe? What do you believe in this? What's your reaction to this? And there was no evidence checking, no fact checking. Sure, she said there's no evidence for that. She said later on that that's a lie. Saying that should not have cut it back then. It certainly doesn't cut it now with where the image of media stand in people's minds. So you can't just say anymore, you know, you're not Edward Murrow. You can't say you're lying and everyone goes, oh my goodness, they're lying. Where was the fact checking? So if he studied this for as long as he did, why didn't she, prior to this interview, ask for the evidence that he found and say, I looked into it. A, B, and C are incorrect because of 1, 2, 3. There was none of that. And so therefore, there continues to be this open avenue for his supporters to say, well, look, he looked at all the angles and you didn't
look at what he looked at.
Exactly.
You didn't debunk it.
Nothing was debunked. You can't just sit there with, you know, this scowl and this note of skepticism in your eyes and say, there's no evidence of that. That is not going to cut it these days. And that was not in the interview anywhere, especially in that part you just played.
Now we'll turn to a subject that can be sensitive. What exactly is cultural appropriation? In June, both the New York Times and NPR ran dueling pieces about it.
Our panel agreed on a basic definition. They said that cultural appropriation is not the same as cultural exchange. Appropriation involves a dominant group taking an idea or a practice from another group that has been exploited and then profiting from that idea. In this clip, a caller first has comments about Elvis Presley, who has been accused many times over the years of a cultural appropriation in his music. Then you'll hear a response from artist, poet, and producer Rena Golden Collier.
I've been thinking about your Elvis analogy, and I think we have to be a little bit careful here because maybe it wasn't his original work. However, he made the sound popular among mass audiences, which then opened the arena up for a lot of black artists, you know, Bo Diddley and Little Richard, Fats Domino. They all came out as a result of that. Now people were listening to, quote unquote, that type of music. And without Elvis being able to start that, even by their own admission, these artists said they would have never been heard or become famous or popular. So I think there's needs to be some credit given to the fact that, yeah, maybe it wasn't the right thing to do necessarily, but it offered an ability for a lot of people to then showcase their work.
Did it, though? I'm asking honestly, Bob. I don't mean to be sort of snarky here. Did it? I mean, did it really open the door for black artists who might have otherwise not? And why was the door closed to begin with?
Oh, well, unfortunately, in the time that Elvis came out, we had, you know, even larger racial problems than we have today. And Rolling Stone did a very long article about the impact of Elvis, and they cite, even John Lennon said before Elvis there was nothing. And it really, truly opened, it was a brand new sound. Now, brand new sound to mass audiences, not a brand new sound to the people who were creating this type of music. But no one was listening to that type of music because people could not get the airtime if you were African American. So Elvis was, I think we should at least credit him for allowing this sound to be accepted.
Right, Bob, thank you for the phone call. I mean, I don't hear someone defending racism, and it's, I hear someone acknowledging that it was structural racism that was preventing the sound from breaking through to begin with. But then, do we give Elvis credit?
Can you imagine what would have happened if Elvis and his producers and those who wanted to see that sound actually go far actually said, we love this sound so much that we want to give the same opportunity that we're giving to Elvis to a black artist who actually originated it. And what that could have done to really, you know, counter some of the, you know, the racial issues with breaking into those industries. And would Elvis have been willing to give up his crown? Is another question. Would he have been willing to take a stand? He didn't give credit. Would, you know, I get the indirect benefits. I kind of get some of those, but the direct ones are much more powerful. If someone had taken advantage of those direct, you know, ties to say, okay, this is not my sound. Here, I'm going to bring this one out on stage, you know, with me, for example. I guess I tend to go back to what has to be done in terms of the undoing before we can start giving credit, you know, to what happened after the fact, just kind of a natural migration. Because what becomes problematic is then when we retell the story, it's even further disempowering to the group that it comes from. Further disempowering in the sense that when we start saying there was nothing before Elvis. There was nothing before this. It was a brand new, like even the language that we use to go back and tell the story, it still erases, right? And then we say, and the side note caveat is that, well, of course we know that some people were listening, but we're not using language that levels, you know, that playing field. And that's where, you know, it's appropriation and not an exchange.
Finally, is it possible for your home to go net zero on energy? In other words, can you make your home so energy efficient that you don't have to really pay bills anymore? Marty Smith from Fairport thinks you can. He began converting just about everything in his house 2 years ago. Today, he has two large solar arrays in his backyard, along with a geothermal system buried under the yard. He updated his windows and insulation and even went to a no-vent dryer.
We had a chance to tour Marty's house in Fairport to see the systems for ourselves, and one of his solar arrays serves as a patio umbrella. He joined us in studio to talk about the effectiveness of generating energy from the geothermal and solar systems. And in this clip, he starts off by talking about the solar component.
Last year was a particularly good year. For those people that remember, we had a bit of a drought. And last year, I produced a full 10 megawatts of power. So in a typical day around this time of the year, if it's a sunny day, I'm producing over 50 kilowatt hours.
In a day?
In a single day.
And remind our listeners who don't know all the breakdown of energy, a kilowatt hour, you know,
A good comparison that I always use when people ask me about that is if you take a 1,000-watt hairdryer, you turn it on for an hour, that's 1 kilowatt hour. So if I have 50, if I produce 51, 52 in a particular day, I could literally have 52 hair dryers running for an hour.
Okay.
So who's going to do that? No, I recognize that that's a silly thing, but it's a good thing for you people to think about.
Sure, absolutely.
Who sits with their hair dryer and just runs it for an hour? I mean, you could literally heat a room that way, but it's not an efficient way to do that either.
Okay, so you're generating a lot, though.
Yeah, but, you know, the cost associated with electricity, a lot of people don't recognize, you know, in that 52 kilowatt hours, if I translate into the cost of what I produced, it's 11 cents a kilowatt hour. So technically, I only made the $5 on a busy sunny day. Now, the problem is when you're making this over a 365-day, you know, year, you're producing a lot of power. It may not seem like a lot of energy, but the efficiencies of it, combining it with the geo and some of the other things that I've done, I've lowered the amount of electricity required. I've created an opportunity to make my own power. And so the end result, when you come to the net look of what it costs and what it does for your household, is just, it's ridiculous. It's so phenomenal.
Again, the difference between, go back, you know, before you'd made these changes to your home, to today, the percentage difference that you're paying in energy costs is what?
Well, I didn't do it by percentage, but okay. I do.
No, you can do it however you want then, however you want.
So basically what I did is I took 2015 and I went back to all my bills and I looked at my credit cards, looked at gasoline costs and so on and so forth, and I wrote it all down. And I actually consider that even before I did the geo and the solar piece that I was relatively efficient, but I was still probably $3,700 plus for a year for heating, cooling, electricity for everything else in the house, and gasoline to operate all the things that I run that are gasoline, like cars, mowers, things like that. And in 2016, I did the same analysis, and I was just over $1,000 for the whole year for everything. So we went from $3,700 to $1,000, $2,700 break for 1 year. It's a pretty good change.
So you're paying just over a quarter. You're paying about maybe 28, 29% of what you used to pay.
Right.
And that will do it for Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great holiday weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.